The CMU podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Apple Music, The Arches, Cobalt's Collecting Society, and why Walmart hates Justin Bieber. I'm Andy Malt, and before I introduce you to Chris Cook, I should take this moment to say hello and welcome to the CMU podcast, which has been away for a while, but now it's back on a weekly basis, right in your head. So this is the first one. Thanks for listening.
Pretty much every Friday morning is the plan.
I said I was going to introduce you, Chris Cook.
Oh, was I not allowed to speak until you'd introduce
Everyone
me?
Forget Chris spoke.
I thought that you saying that you were going to introduce me was introducing me.
No.
Oh, sorry. In which case, I'm not here.
Well, I'll do it now.
Okay.
With me, I have Chris Cook, and he is going to tell you, as if you didn't already know, what Apple announced this week.
So, yes, a big Apple announcement for the week of the return of the CMU podcast. And, okay, everybody's been talking about this week. Apple Music was finally announced on Monday evening. It was Monday evening, wasn't it? It feels like it was weeks ago. It was just days ago. So Apple finally got round to entering the streaming market. We've been expecting this for, what, 2 years now? They already had sort of entered the streaming market in the US with iTunes Radio, which was sort of a Pandora personalized radio type service. Then a year ago, they bought Beats and Beats Music, and everyone was like, oh, they're just going to quickly turn this around. Slap an Apple logo on it and that'll be Apple in streaming. But no, they wanted to do something totally different. And that totally different thing is what they launched on Monday. Although I say totally different for them, well, but not for us.
Apple said that it had revolutionised music. It was changing the way you listen to music forever. Chris Cook, how did they do that?
Well, first of all, they didn't.
Oh.
Despite Tim Cook, I think it was, who said that, Apple boss.
Yeah.
But it's basically bringing various different elements of the digital music experience together. So the iTunes download store is still part of Apple Music. That's not going anywhere just yet. Download sales may have peaked 2 years ago. They are now in decline. We think they're probably going to decline quite fast over the next year or two. But nevertheless, it is still, actually here in the UK, the single biggest digital revenue stream. It certainly was last year. So the iTunes store will still be there. But there's two or arguably three other elements to this. So first of all, you have the freemium element, the free streaming bit, which we originally thought might be an extension of what I said, the iTunes Radio. So yeah. iTunes Radio already exists. It's a free service in America. It's a personalized radio service. It guesses what you like and then plays you a personalized stream. That's been going for a while in the US. We knew that we were not going to get a full freemium strand on Apple Music. We knew it wasn't going to be like Spotify, where basically the free service is the same as the paid-for service, but with ads and no full mobile functionality. We knew that the freemium bit of this service was not going to be that sophisticated, but I think we thought it was going to be more sophisticated than it is. Basically, it's a radio station. Beats One, it's called.
Yes, they are
the world's first 24/7 global radio station.
Yeah,
think is how they said it.
I think initially we were like, "Well, how's that going to work? So how are they going to like time shift it so that people get the right sort of show at the right sort of time?" But no, I think like if you're listening to Friday night in LA, you get it at whatever it'll be 6 o'clock in the morning in the UK.
Studios so in three cities around the world.
It's sort of showing why people don't have global radio stations.
How they'll do time checks, we don't know. As you say, it means that some people it'll be breakfast time, some people it will be drive time, some people it'll be sort of specialist show time. So how it will work, we're not sure. But basically, Beats One, it's a straight radio station. And I think it's simply there to try and get people excited. It's a cheap way to have some big name content, isn't it? Rather than having to do massive exclusivity deals with artists, although we suspect there'll be a few of those as well. But you can just get people in radio style, try and get people excited. Obviously, Zane Lowe, we knew, had already been hired to front this service. He was there at the launch talking about it. So it's a way of getting people excited into the new Apple Music platform. And while they're there, well, if they're old timers, they might want to buy some downloads. But really, we want to sell them up to the streaming service. The streaming service, well, it's $10 a month, unlimited, on demand, the same number of tracks, a few playlists. Basically, it's the streaming service like every other streaming service, but it's from Apple and we're expecting a few exclusives.
Yeah, we are. I mean, they did. That was the whole thing. I mean, with the overblown state, we're talking about, you know, revolutionising the way you listen to music forever by launching a radio station and a streaming service. And then they kind of sort of patronisingly ran through
what a radio station was.
No, the streaming service. They got demonstrating on the screen going, and you can put your music in playlist and look, you can move the tracks around. You can completely change the order. It's not like a CD. It was just weird. I mean, you know, it is a big deal that Apple has entered the streaming market, no doubt.
And but I suppose Jimmy Iovine, yeah. who obviously is the ex Universal Music executive, who was one of the founders and bosses at Beats, who then came to Apple through the Beats acquisition, and his thing was. I mean, he didn't quite say it like this, but basically what he was saying was, OK, none of this is particularly original, but we're bringing it all in one place. And his big thing was, the problem with music today is you have to go here for your music, here for your video, here for your social media. Let's put it all in one place. Obviously, the weakness of that argument is, well, most of those services you're talking about do offer everything. It's just that music fans have decided that they want to get their music here, their video here, their social media here. They've chosen to do it in different places. So putting it all in one place, I don't think means that is particularly clever, and it's not necessarily going to pull people in. But there was this other element. I mentioned that there were three, maybe four. I've talked about the three, the iTunes Store, Beats One Radio, the streaming service. And then there's this thing called Connect. Now, you actually sat through... I was busy on Monday. I got stuff to do. So Andy sat through the entire presentation. So you were there when they explained Connect. What's Connect?
I don't know. It's basically...
This was the bit that Drake introduced, is that right?
Yeah. Drake waffled on for it. I don't know. Like, Drake, I don't think he realised we'd been sitting there for more than 2 hours at this point. And like all the tech people obviously were excited about the other stuff they were talking about. The music people had been sitting there for over 2 hours waiting for this bloody announcement.
Yeah, unlike I suppose Spotify, where when Spotify make an announcement, the music is the announcement. But for Apple, music is, it's just the and finally. They've got a huge long list of things to tell us. And it's like, oh, and finally, here's some music nonsense.
And then Drake walks on a waffles for 5 minutes. We're all sitting there going, what are you talking about, Drake? We just get off the stage and just get this finished. Anyway, but he was there to talk up how
Connect.
Excited he was about Connect, which is basically a social network sort of thing. It's sort of competing with or trying to compete with SoundCloud and YouTube and Facebook a bit. And it sort of allows, if you're an artist, you can sign up to it and you can post tracks and videos and status updates and things. I mean,
and although they made a big deal about how any unsigned artist can do this, to an extent, I suppose what they're saying is artists whose music is already in the Apple streaming service, so established artists, this is a way that they can pump content into the Apple platform. So they can put photos or video clips or little messages that will somehow sit within the Apple Music ecosystem alongside the streams and the downloads and everything else.
Yeah, and it's sort of...
connected, well, I'm guessing. Assuming that's the point of the word. They're not naming it after the defunct Barclays debit card. I'm assuming that there's some sort of connection thing going on.
Yeah, I mean, and it's basically the idea that you can connect with your fans. But, I mean, the problem is... I mean, they really talked up how this was...
revolutionary.
Well, this is sort of what Drake was saying. Drake was saying, the problem is, these days, you've got all these different things that you've got to share your content on, and it's a job in itself managing them, and as an artist, you just want to get on with the job of making music. And then Apple played this video showing how you could get on with the job of making music by posting status updates and videos and photos that would seem to be getting in the way of creating music. In fact, it was artists sharing photos of their lyrics and talking about how they were about to record a track. So it was actually getting in the way of them making music.
Making their bloody songs. And I suppose, although it will be somehow linked into Twitter, and so when you post to Apple Connect, it will pump out an update to those social networks. I mean, the idea that the average artist is going to stop putting videos on YouTube, the biggest video network for music in the world that always comes top in a Google search, the idea they're going to give up on YouTube and put all their videos in Apple, of course that's not going to happen.
I mean, it's
and also all it means is these artists who are busy and they want to write their bloody songs have now got to keep Apple Connect up to date, as well as YouTube, as well as Twitter, as well as Facebook. It's another bloody channel.
And it's sort of, I mean, it shows this is, I think it's a common problem. I think this is the problem with various things that Apple have done in the past, not least Ping, is that there's a sort of arrogance that everyone would want to stay within Apple's ecosystem. So, you know, the benefit of SoundCloud and YouTube is that you can embed those players anywhere. That is kind of the beauty of them, that they're sort of universal ways of distributing your music.
And I think there's a strong argument that is why they have become so big.
Yeah.
Is because you put them where your fans are already hanging out. The fact that behind the scenes they're coming in from YouTube or SoundCloud is irrelevant to the user.
Yeah, and Apple Connect does not have that. It just assumes that, hey, everyone's just going to want to hang out in Apple Connect. Why would you want to go to Facebook or anywhere else? So it's I don't know. It's like all these things are sort of, they're interesting things that happen, but there's all kind of, as soon as you start thinking about any of these things that Apple has announced, you kind of think, oh, there's sort of some problems with that.
But all of that said, despite having spent the entirety of our podcast so far dissing Apple Music, it is worth mentioning. I mean, there are plenty of people in the music industry who are very excited about this. And as really, they're not so much excited about the product. It's not that they were necessarily expecting Apple to do anything revolutionary. What Apple have is scale. OK, and so Spotify, actually, 2 days after the big announcement, Spotify came out with their latest user figures. They are impressive. What was it? It was 75 million users in total, of which 20 million are paying. Is that right?
75 million active users.
And 20 million paying subscribers. And OK, they're pretty impressive figures. They're certainly impressive figures in the context of the streaming music market. But Apple have hundreds of millions of people signed up to iTunes. They have those people's email addresses. They have those people's credit card details. The next time iPhone owners, I mean, ultimately, this will be available on Android devices too, but iPhone users are the important people. The next time you update your iPhone, suddenly Apple Music will be there. It'll say, press a button, and all of this will start working. You'll then be into a 3-month free trial, so you'll be able to access the entire package for free for 3 months. And the hope is that over those 3 months, enough of those people will become excited that they'll say, yeah, I'll pay $10 a month for this, and we'll start to hook new people in. And for the music industry, if Apple Music just steals Spotify subscribers, which I don't think they will, I mean, Spotify killer was the line on Monday, I don't think they're going to nab Spotify's users. And for the music industry, that's the last thing they want. They want those 20 million paying users at Spotify to continue being Spotify subscribers and for that to grow. What they want is the people who have never really taken up to streaming, certainly not fully on-demand streaming, that this might huck them in, and then we get a brand new revenue stream over here to compensate for the fact that our download revenues are now in decline.
It's, yeah, the mainstream users who they want, really. And that's, I guess that's why they, I mean, that's why they've got a radio station rather than a personalised kind of not on-demand streaming service. They've gone for an actual radio station because
That's what mainstream people
are still listening to.
So there is a bit of logic there. And the fact it's called Beats One. I mean, you mentioned that the problem of having one radio station for everybody in the world seems a little bit naive. Having said that, Beats One suggests that Beats Two, Beats Three, Beats Four will come down the line. And whether or not those will have any geographical bias or whether they will try and pitch to different people, who knows? So, you know, we're not writing Apple Music off, but it's not. I mean, all the hype that they were coming out on Monday night, it's not revolutionary, but it is a massive player in the market, now in the streaming game, and will they be able to help the music industry turn more of those $30 a year downloaders into $120 a year subscribers? I think it's still a big challenge, but it will be interesting to see, and it is an exciting development.
I mean, I suppose, just ending on that point, they are trying to bring people into streaming, but the people in the download side are spending maybe $30 a year on music on average, and they're being asked to spend $120. People on the radio side, I don't really see how the free radio station upsells people to streaming, other than having adverts for the streaming service on it. But if you're kind of going, hey, you've got this global 24-hour thing here that will always play you music whenever you want, why don't you have another thing where you can always listen to music whenever you want, but pay for it?
I suppose in the US, iHeartRadio is a massively successful streaming service. And the reason for that is because iHeartRadio owned the majority of the FM radio stations in the US. So many of the traditional radio stations are owned by iHeartMedia, used to be called Clear Channel, and they relentlessly push iHeartRadio. And that's why everyone thinks, I think it was something like 70 million subscribers in the US alone they announced this week. Having said that, iHeartRadio is a free service. So I mean, to take people from a $30 a year download customer up to $120, we know Apple didn't want that to be the price point. They were pitching originally for something closer to $60, which seems more realistic. So it is still a big ask, but who knows? If you're going to be optimistic, well, perhaps this will be the moment where subscriptions really go madly mainstream. We'll see. So on to live music now, and in amongst all of the excitement around the arrival of Apple Music earlier this week, here in the UK, and particularly if you're a music fan in Scotland, there was some bad news, which was that the Glasgow venue, The Arches, which, I mean, most people in music will know it as a gig venue and a club venue in Glasgow, although actually it was a complete uber arts place. They had theatre, they had all sorts of other cultural stuff happening there. The Arches in Glasgow is no more, okay? And it's not that they've just gone out of business because they've screwed up the finances. It's quite depressing, the reason why this great Glasgow venue is literally, it shut up its door this week. So tell us how we reached this point.
Well, it's been an ongoing story, But basically, various things have happened over the last year, but particularly kind of bunched up in the last month or so. Where the Archers, they had a few issues with a number of alcohol and drug-related incidents happening outside the venue or in the venue.
Somehow linked to the venue.
Linked to the venue, mainly their club nights. So they were placed on a period of monitoring by the police and made to kind of put in various new safety measures and things to kind of
If you were going to a club at the Archers in recent months, you would have noticed that the security had been ramped up and there was a lot more checks going on as people gone in. But to be fair to the venue, they're not some dodgy club space. They have been working with the police and they put these changes in place, even though they weren't particularly consumer-friendly changes. And as far as they're concerned, they were doing everything right.
Yes, and then it came up for a licence review with the local council, and the council decided to restrict their licensed opening hours, which essentially meant that they could no longer run club nights.
Yes, because so basically it meant the time they could open till, rather than running all the way until the middle of the night with a club night, it was sort of a late evening shutting time, which basically meant all of the clubs in the calendar had to be cancelled.
Yeah, and basically when you might say, but they've got all this other stuff going on, theatre, comedy, gigs. Why don't they just,
carry on doing that?
But the problem is, it's a charity-run venue. A lot of its funding comes from various funds in Scotland for cultural activities, but 51% of its income came from those club nights.
Yes, so those off-the-head covers were subsidising the really interesting arty theatre cultural gig stuff that was going on in that venue.
So
and they had some great educational stuff there. I've done educational stuff at the Archers. They had some really great programmes for people who aspire to work in the music industry or in other cultural areas too.
Yeah, and that meant basically overnight, their income was halved, and they were left kind of wondering what to do. They did try to battle on. They took legal advice on whether they could appeal the licensing decision. They talked to their various backers about maybe increasing their funding, and I think at least one of them did say they would increase the funding, but not by enough to kind of make up that shortfall.
No, it's interesting because the last we heard, wasn't it, that they were consulting lawyers as to whether or not they could appeal this decision by the Glasgow Licensing Authority, what they would have to do, what the chances were. And I think, at that point, it seemed that they were still a little bit optimistic.
There was some fight in them.
They could weather this storm and do it. So actually, when on Wednesday afternoon, a post suddenly went on their website saying, no, we are closed as of now. Yeah. Anything that has booked in, unfortunately, is cancelled. The company's been put into administration. It was quite a shock, and it was interesting. I mean, obviously, for the Glasgow music scene and the Glasgow clubbing scene, a particular shock. But I think it was interesting. Across the whole of the UK, this is a venue that has a reputation far beyond the city in which it is based.
Yeah.
And you had lots of Londoners who barely ever go to Glasgow saying, oh my God, I can't believe that venue, which has always seemed to be such a responsibly run venue, is being put out of business by this licensing issue.
And I mean, there seemed to be two reasons. Obviously, the big reason for it was this kind of, these licensing regulations cutting off all their clubbing activity. That was the big thing, and they sort of suggested that they'd taken legal advice, and the legal advice was you should just shut this down. But they also, I think it was the guy, their chief executive, whatever, the person at the top, said that another big problem was that all the restrictions they'd put in place, the safety measures, so the stronger checks on the door, had really turned off clubbers, and it felt if you have to go through various checks on your way into a place, it doesn't make you feel like this is a fun place to go, and so people hadn't been going, and it meant that they were they'd actually ended last year at a deficit.
Yeah, they were already struggling because of those changes, and then this was sort of the final nail in the coffin, as it were. So it's a real shame, and the Arches, they are Arches underneath one of the Glasgow stations. I can't remember which one, Queen Street, I think, but basically they're all disused Arches underneath one of the stations in Glasgow. And the venue originally came about, didn't it? Because Glasgow was one of those European cities of culture.
Yeah.
I mean, like 20-odd years ago now.
1990, yeah.
Well, they're 25 years ago. And it was out of that these Arches started being used for cultural stuff and for clubs, and out of that became this really big venue that then became a really serious cultural hub in Glasgow. And I spend a month of my year in Edinburgh. We're covering the festival, and the Edinburgh cultural community for years has always been saying, oh, if only we could have something like the Arches in Edinburgh. So Edinburgh wanted to replicate it and never really, well, not really did in quite the same way. So it is a shame. And it's interesting that this has all happened last week at MIDEM. Okay, MIDEM happened last week in Cannes, the big music business conference. And that Music Canada were there with the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, the Global Record Industry Trade Body, putting out a report, basically bigging up the impact having a great music community can have on the economy of a regional city. And I knew a little bit about that report already, because at the Great Escape this year, the day before the Great Escape, we had a separate conference called Music Cities, and Music Canada were there, and they gave us a few little preview elements of this report at that event. And it's a really interesting report, and it focuses on a number of cities around the world. Austin is probably the prime one, which is really built on the back of South by Southwest, but other cities too, which have spotted that they've naturally got a good music community. They're the sort of city where there's lots of artists and people who want to work in the business, and producers and songwriters. Normally that happens because you've got somewhere where it's cheap to live. That's usually how a music community first emerges. But then once you've got that music community, if you can provide them with the venues and the rehearsal spaces and a bit of education, that can grow into a thriving music business, and it can have all sorts of impacts. Aside from the cultural impacts, obviously, things like tech startups tend to be drawn to where the music community is. So if you have a thriving music community, tech startups come in, which then brings investment in. Also, you then get lots of entrepreneurs, and when you've got lots of great entrepreneurs, then people tend to become more employable. And there's all these reasons why having a thriving music community, particularly for a regional city like Glasgow, is a really good idea.
Yeah. Well, I suppose the kind of the initial spark is that if you do something to keep those people in your city, they're not going, you know, people in Glasgow who are talented and creative aren't moving to, say, London.
And that's a massive thing for those regional cities that have a little bit of a music community. Is the big fear always is that you just lose everybody to a London or a New York, a city that has an established music industry, and everyone goes, oh, well, I'm just going to go there. So it was just interesting that within a week of this great report coming out, that this was almost Glasgow's becoming an anti-music city. And of course, at the same time as MIDEM was happening in Cannes, down in Brighton was the Brighton Music Conference, which is a dance music focused conference. And there, the recently launched, what's it called?
It's the Nighttime Industries Association.
So it's basically different companies who offer nighttime entertainment. So it's predominantly the clubbing industry, although there are some gig venues in there, there's some bar venues in there too. But they've recently launched, and one of the reasons they launched, and one of the reasons why they were speaking at the Brighton Music Conference, is because an increasing number of venues are having these licensing issues. Each one's slightly different. They're all based in different local authorities. But, you know, there are a number of venues which have either closed or have come close. I mean, obviously, we looked like we might lose Fabric here in London late last year. And saying that, you know, obviously the local authorities have a job to do, but they should be working more closely with the clubbing industry, recognising the value of having these nightlife things there and helping them thrive.
Yeah, so it was I think Alan D. Miller is his name, the guy who runs the Nighttime Industries Association, and he gave a keynote at Brighton Music Conference and was basically kind of warning against exactly what has happened to the arches, saying that kind of that it's becoming increasingly difficult to run venues after 10 o'clock at night because local councils are placing more strict regulations. As they said, he was talking about a lot of venues now have their clientele breathalyzed before they come in, and it's really, you know, turning people off, and it's kind of destroying a economically valuable area of industry, which maybe has a. He was saying, you know, maybe it has this kind of unnecessarily kind of bad reputation, whereas actually most people who go out, you know, after 10 o'clock at night are not out to cause trouble.
They're out to spend money.
They're out to spend money, yeah.
Which is a good thing.
And as we've seen with the artists, by restricting these too heavily, you risk losing them, and you risk losing all the benefits that come with having those venues and communities there.
And the Nighttime Industry Association, I know, have got a lot of activity coming up in the next few months to try and rally the cause, both to bring the promoters to the table and then to go and lobby. And it's a shame that this is such a great case study for them, because we really wish it hadn't happened. But it is. I mean, I think this will be a story that they can go and tell and hopefully fix it elsewhere so we don't lose other venues like this. So for music business stuff, to the actual music that this business is all about. Every week on the all-new CMU podcast, Andy is going to be talking us through the CMU approveds of the previous 7 days. So every day in the CMU Daily, Andy tips an artist or a record or a video, something that he's discovered. It may be new talent, it may be existing talent, established talent, doing something interesting and new that he thinks you, the CMU readers, should go and check out. And so we thought here on the podcast, we'd do a really quick run through what he has been approving in the previous 7 days. So are you ready?
Yes.
You ready to explain why, justify why you were tipping these bands?
I didn't know I was on trial.
Oh, yes. This is where we test whether or not you've really put the thought in. So we'll just quickly, I'll name the four artists that you've approved this week, and you can tell us in just a sentence why we should be checking them out.
Yes.
So let's start with Envy.
Okay, Envy are kind of Japanese or post-rock sort of band, but actually their new track that they've just released, I think it was last week actually, is more kind of in a hardcore vein, which is sort of more leaning towards where they were 20 years ago when they first formed. And it's taken from their first album in 5 years. And yeah, it's quite exciting because so they're a good band.
Go check that out. The next one, The Casual Sexists.
They are a husband and wife team, Ed and Varick Zed, who they have kind of an eclectic range of influences, which you can hear. They gave us a mixtape with, I think, 9 tracks that had influenced their new EP that's coming out. And we also posted a track called World of Noise, which is sort of Ed Zed's half-wrapped autobiography in 3 minutes.
So go check out that track, and then also click via the CMU site to our Mixcloud channel where you can listen to that little mixtape that they created for us. How the hell do I even say this? Fan Fanu?
Well, no, because the letters are very different to what you
just
said.
Oh, yeah. Fufanu.
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 Good job we rehearsed that before we started this part of the podcast.
They're an Icelandic...
Of course they are.
Post-punk band. They got a new single out called Will We Last, off a new EP that's coming out. I think the thing that drew me to this track is it has a really, like, the chorus of it, the kind of the vocals and the guitar line really, like, grind against each other, and it's very pleasing.
And finally, I can say this one, Mags.
Mags, that's an easy one. She has just released her first track, which is apparently the first of a trilogy of tracks to introduce her to the world. It's called Etta James, the first track, although she's not saying that she is the new Etta James, I don't think, but she is apparently a purveyor of very dramatic pop. It's very string-heavy, drama-filled, which she has actually worked as an actress, so maybe that's why.
So some brand new talent there.
A brand new artist to check out. If you go to completemusicupdate.com/approved, you can find all four of those and listen to them.
And also on the website, you will find every month Andy puts together a playlist of everything he has approved in the previous 30 days. And the May approved playlist is still there spinning away. So you can check that out on the website too, completemusicupdate.com.
So Apple's big music announcement was obviously the big music business story of this week. And then after that, I guess, Spotify announcing its figures, both user figures and some investment. But the story that really caught our eye this week and we thought was a very, potentially very big development was that Cobalt launched its own collecting society.
I was almost tempted to put this as top story on Tuesday ahead of the Apple announcement, but then we sort of decided at the last minute that so many people were talking about Apple, we shouldn't do. But yeah.
So Cobalt is a music publisher and artist and label services company. Why would they want a collecting society?
It's very interesting, isn't it? So, I mean, Cobalt have been a very hyped company of late. So originally they were a music publishing company, although I suppose unusually for a music publishing company, they were predominantly administrators of other people's publishing rights. In more recent years, they bought up quite a lot of catalogue themselves. But they were a company that if you owned songs, whether that was because you were a small publisher or you were an artist who owned your own copyright, but you wanted somebody else to deal with all the administration, collecting in the money, then Cobalt would do it for you. And in recent years, they've really grown. They've added label services. They've added so-called neighbouring rights. And all the hype has been around their technology because they've built this platform that means that if you are a songwriter who uses Cobalt to collect in your money, they try and make it much easier for you to see where your money's coming in, how much money's coming in, how much you should be expecting, when you should get paid. And I think songwriters, even more than artists, often they get a check-in from their publisher and from their collecting society at the end of each quarter, and they've no idea where the money came from. And so Cobalt are really trying to help people figure it all out, help creators, songwriters figure it all out. And that technology platform which they launched a few years ago, has become really big talking point. And it's interesting in the last year that the tech press have really latched on to what Cobalt are doing because they have this technology product at the heart. And so Wired ran a big cover story, didn't they, about how Cobalt was saving the music industry with data. And sometimes you do feel there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening here, but some of it is hype. You know, there are other companies doing this. In some ways, what they're doing, it's one of those things where it's like, well, of course a music publishing company should be doing all of this stuff. It's just that everyone else is so rubbish at doing it. That's why it sort of stands out. So we're always wary of buying into the hype around Cobalt Music, because I think some of it is hype. Although this, as you say, is very interesting. So Cobalt have set up a collecting society.
Well, I asked you why Cobalt would want a collecting society, and you didn't answer that. But before I ask you to go back and answer that question, I think we should go back a little bit further, because we've assumed here that everyone listening understands what a collecting society is and why it exists.
Yeah, that's why I didn't answer your question, because I knew you'd ask the wrong one.
Yeah, of course. Of course, it's my fault.
Yeah. So I suppose to understand what collecting societies are, you have to know that there is such a thing as collective licensing. So whenever somebody wants to use a song or a recording, whether they want to play it on the radio or they want to perform it live or they want to use it in an advert or whatever, if you want to make use of a song or a recording, and often you want to make use of both, you have to go and get permission from the copyright owner. So if you want to use a song, you have to get permission from the person who wrote the song, or more commonly their publisher. If you want to use a recording, you have to get permission from the record company who owns the recording.
However, that sounds like a pain in the ass, doesn't it?
It does. And there are a number of scenarios where, rather than having to go and find every songwriter and publisher and every record company and doing lots of different deals, there are certain scenarios where the music industry decides to license collectively. So what that means is, if you're a radio station, rather than having to have hundreds of deals with publishers and hundreds of deals with record companies, you can go to two organisations. So the publishers appoint one organisation, in the UK it would be PRS. The record companies appoint another organisation, in the UK it's PPL. And then those organisations represent all of the rights. So as a radio station, I can go and get my licence from PRS and PPL. They give me a blanket licence. And what that means is I can now play any recordings and any songs on my radio station, and I'm covered. I'm covered. I have to then pay money, and the licence will tell me what I have to pay and when I have to pay. But I pay the money to PRS, or I pay it to PPL, and they then pass it on. They collect the money, and then they distribute the money to the rights owners, usually based on usage. So every time a record gets played on, say, daytime Radio 1, the BBC have to pay some money to both PRS and PPL, and then PRS and PPL then have to pass that on to the people who own the copyright, and you know, probably to the song writers and sometimes to the performers as well. So that's what collective licensing is, and that's why collecting societies exist.
Well, good. Very well explained. Now, why would Cobalt want one?
This is all about digital licensing. So the thing about collective licensing is there's many scenarios in which it works, and that's why collective licensing exists. It's great for radio, for example. It's great for live music. However, collective licensing has a few issues attached to it, and there are probably two, maybe three big issues. I can think of two. I might think of a third. So the big issues are, first of all, collective licensing has always existed on a national basis, not an international basis. So in every country, the publishers have a collecting society and the record companies have a collecting society. But those are different collecting societies in every country. So if you're a UK radio station, you go to the UK society. If you're a German station, you go to the German societies. And then all those societies are linked together through global agreements. So the UK stations can play German music because the UK society has an agreement with the German society, and vice versa. So the society system was sort of set up to operate on a national basis. The other snag about collective licensing is competition law is always concerned about collective licensing, because for competition law, it looks like the music industry are sort of forming a cartel so that they can hold licensees to ransom. And so to overcome that concern, the minute you start licensing collectively, a whole load of extra rules are applied by copyright law, which aren't there if you're negotiating direct. Now, this is particularly relevant for digital, because A, the vast majority of digital services want to be global. They don't want to just be in the UK or just in Germany. And they don't want to have to do a separate deal with every single collecting society for the publishers and for the record companies worldwide. On the rights owners' side, they don't like licensing digital collectively because they don't like being subject to these extra regulations. We know that when the major record companies license a Spotify-type service, they make big demands. They want an advance, they want equity, they want minimum guarantees. And if you did that through collective licensing, there's a very high chance that the regulations would say, no, you can't make those demands. You've got to accept, you know, less favourable terms. And so the music industry has been trying to decide, when it comes to digital, do we license directly or do we license collectively? The record companies almost always, there's a handful of exceptions, but almost always license directly for the reasons I mentioned. We can do multi-territory licenses and we're not subject to collective licensing rules. The problem is for the publishers that collective licensing makes much more sense in publishing than it does in the labels, mainly because most songs are co-owned and co-written. The average pop song is written by 2 people, 5 people, 7, 22 people. And the minute a song is co-written, it is now owned by multiple people. So what that means is if I want to use that song, I have to go and do deals with every single publisher who has a stake in that song. That's where collective licensing is great. I now don't have to go and talk to 11 people. I have one license and it covers everything. So collective licensing has always made a lot more sense in publishing than it does for the record companies. You also have an issue, particularly in Europe, that the publishers' collecting societies are much more powerful than the record industry's collecting societies for historical reasons. So if you're a songwriter in the UK, when you do a deal with a publisher, you give the publisher your copyright. That's what a publishing deal is. But you don't give them the performing right, which is the bit that people need if they're going to broadcast your stuff on radio, if they're going to perform it live. You actually give that to PRS, and then you give the publisher a right to collect half of the money that PRS collects. So that gives PRS a lot more power. PRS isn't just a middleman agent between the publisher and the radio station or whoever. They actually control that element of the copyright. And when it comes to digital and especially streaming, what a stream is partly a performance. It's partly a communication of the song. So when your streaming services licenses songs, they need to get both bits of the copyright, the bit that the publisher controls, which includes what we would call the mechanical copy, and the bit that the collecting society controls, which is the performing right. So the publishers can't cut the collecting societies completely out of the equation, but just like the labels, they recognise the problem with licensing collectively is multi-territory issues and the extra regulation. So what the publishers have done in Europe is they've tried to find a sort of a happy medium where the big publishers, so Sony, Universal, Warner, BMG and Cobalt, have formed joint ventures with a collecting society. So BMG work with Gamer in Germany, and they've just renewed that deal. They announced that this week. Sony ATV often work with PRS here in the UK. And so the publisher and the collecting societies license together. And what that means is that they can overcome the regulations because they're now technically licensing direct, even though the collecting societies are involved. And also, all the collecting societies have agreements with each other that allow them to do multi-territory deals. So this is a very roundabout way of explaining it's complicated. I'm going to write all this down and you can read it. But that's how the publishers are licensing digital. However, that's just in Europe. That's only happening in Europe. And so what Cobalt have done is, whereas in the past they worked with Stim in Sweden to do the same thing as everyone else is doing, Cobalt has said, no. Just Europe isn't enough. We need to have a global collecting society. We need to have a society that is able to work globally. And that's what this is. So what they've done is they've bought an existing society.
Yes, so they bought the American Mechanical Rights Association.
And then cleverly renamed it.
The American Music Rights Association.
Because they're not interested in just the mechanical rights. They want it to be both mechanical rights and performing rights. Hopefully I've explained what that means. You don't need to know. So they bought this society. They own it. It's called AMRA. And Cobalt will now work with AMRA on its digital licensing. And it's great for Cobalt for two reasons. Because they have the control, A, they can now try and do global licensing deals through this vehicle, whereas with Stim they were just doing it on a European basis. And B, because they control the society and they've not got to navigate all of the other members who have a say over how the society is run, they can insist that AMRA uses their great technology platform I mentioned. So AMRA will license the Cobalt technology. So it will be using the same technology platform as Cobalt. So Cobalt now will be able to have a much more efficient flow of data. There are still some flaws in all of this, but some much more efficient flow of data and therefore a much more efficient flow of the money.
Now, you talked a lot there about Cobalt having control, but actually Cobalt's been very specific in saying that this is going to remain a separate company. It's not part of Cobalt. It is its own thing. But why would they be so keen to make people know that.
It's interesting, isn't it? So it is owned by Cobalt, but totally separately run. And they've hired PricewaterhouseCoopers, who do not come cheap, to do a load of stuff, I don't know what, to confirm to the world this is a definitely autonomously run organisation. And I think there are two reasons for that. Reason one is that now they've bought Amra and set it all up, they want other publishers to use it, okay? They will use it, and it really helps the Cobalt machine, but they want Amra to be bigger than that. And so they're trying to persuade other publishers. And when I spoke to the boss of Cobalt earlier this week about this, he was even sort of saying, I think one of the major publishers might be interested in this. But they want other publishers to use it. And obviously, other publishers are going to say, well, why would we shunt all of our digital licensing through a competitor organization? So they're keen to say, no. Amra isn't a competitor organisation. There's also the other issue that I sort of touched on, which is the minute you start doing this complicated, partly direct, partly collective licensing on a multi-territory basis, it requires all the collecting societies around the world to work together and that they have agreements where money moves backwards and forwards. So if I'm using Cobalt to represent my music, but I'm a PRS member, there needs to be a system in place where Cobalt do the deal through Amra, the money comes into Amra, but then my cut as songwriter doesn't go to Cobalt, it comes to PRS, and then I get paid it on my PRS check. And so Amra needs to have agreements with all of the other societies for this to work, which is A, why they bought an existing society, rather than trying to set something up for scratch, because Amra already has these agreements, because it has always existed, albeit in a much smaller way. So all these agreements are already there, but, you know, Cobalt will be nervous if this is seen too much as being a division of Cobalt. The other societies will get a little bit nervous of that. They'll be saying, oh, when our deals come up for renewal, will we want to renew? So it's a way of saying to the other collecting societies, this is a standalone society just like any other collecting organisation. So, you know, you should continue to work with us. It remains to be seen in the coming months how the other societies respond. We have been told Amra will have a lot of announcements over the summer. It'll be interesting to see what those announcements are. But this is exciting because all of the stuff Cobalt have been doing to try and make the flow of information and money more efficient has generally been limited by the fact that a big chunk of the money in publishing has to go through the collecting societies. And I think it's one of the reasons why songwriters are getting so tetchy about their digital income. They don't really understand where the income's going. They don't really know who's taking a cut, etc., etc. Cobalt are trying to simplify it. It's always been hard to do that because the collecting societies are involved. By having a collecting society, it gives them more power to do what they want to do. So, don't know if any of that made sense. Just take note. It's a big news story and it's something to watch in the coming years.
So after that dense analysis of Cobalt and collecting societies, let's have a quick run through the things we haven't had time to talk about this week. New Music Fridays, in one sentence, what is that?
The global release date is here. It's called New Music Fridays. It launches in July.
Okay, Line Music bringing streaming to Japan.
That's... This is another potentially big story. Unfortunately, I spoke for so long about Cobalt, we don't have time. But basically, the messaging app Line has added streaming music to the equation in Japan, which is important because it's Japan. And there is so few streaming services in Japan, and now there is one.
But still, no, none of the big, like Spotify's, radios, any of that, Deezer, etc. David Guetta is writing the official song of Euro 2016.
Nothing else to add.
Nothing to add, because there's the battle over the BB King estate.
Yeah, so BB King sadly died last month. Was it last month?
It was.
Yes. And as sometimes happens, he has a big family, his estate is controlled by his business manager, and they're all falling out. So there's going to be lots of legal wranglings around the BB King estate in the coming months.
There's the indie labels are entering the breakage debate, asking where do bits of advances.
Yeah, there ain't time to talk about the breakage debate. Go to the CMU website and we'll tell you all about that. Look out for Alison Wenham's letter, which is there in full at completemusicupdate.com.
The BPI's new copyright protection portal.
That launched at MeDem. More MeDem news there.
You can guess what that is. HMV claiming responsibility for the vinyl revival. Yes. And planning to do a Father's Day promotion.
You weren't very impressed with HMV saying that they're going to take vinyl mainstream again.
Neither were any independent record shops. Jesse J, Jenny Aiko and Rixton have recorded a song for Pop Tarts for some
reason. I
don't
think any more needs to be said about that.
And
then this is just here because of your headline. Tell us the story.
Ariana Grande's Very Bad Journey. I'm not going to add any more to that.
This was last week's Beef of the Week. Ariana Grande, it was more her mother, had a massive falling out with P&O Ferries in Calais, I think.
A pop star falling out with P&O Ferries is just funny in itself. That's all you need to know.
Beef of the Week on CompleteMusicUpdate.com, and you'll find out more about that there. Hey, we're running out of time, but we just a few minutes to talk about one last story. So how are we going to wrap up this week, Andy Malt?
Well, let's look at Walmart, which has announced that it's going to put in its own in-store radio station. Which, you know, that's a story in itself. But the reason that they're launching their own in-store radio station is because their staff have been complaining that the store basically provides one CD for all stores, that it plays on a loop the whole time. So if you're a customer there, you're there for an hour, you probably don't notice. But if you're working there, you're hearing the same CD on a loop all the time. It's such a thing that it's actually become a joke
within Walmart.
In Walmart training videos.
and there were certain artists. I mean, they were proper pop songs on these CDs and proper pop stars singing them. But there were certain artists who Walmart staff were particularly picking out as winding them up as they came round on a loop again and again and again.
Celine Dion and Justin Bieber were pinpointed as artists who are really, really getting to the staff.
So Walmart HR, this is all obviously in the US. Obviously, Walmart do own Asda here in the UK, but I think Asda used to have Asda FM. I don't know if it still does have a cheesy in-store radio station, but this is in the US. And after sort of thrusting Bieber and Dion down the ears of their staff for so long, they've finally decided to a bit of staff welfare. They're getting rid of that, and they're going to have an in-store radio. Don't know what that means, but presumably it will be like any other in-store radio stations somewhere. Somebody will be playing some records, and it'll be pumped out in all of the stores across America.
That comes with its own issues.
It can do, can't
it? We'll see how it goes. It's still got to be better than just one CD on a loop.
Just one CD on a loop. Although let's hope they don't follow the lead of the Co-op here in the UK, who for a while had the ruse of only playing unsigned bands in their store on their in-store radio station, because then you don't have to pay the aforementioned PRS or PPL any royalties.
Assuming they're not registered with PRS.
Yes, assuming those unsigned bands are not registered with those societies. But turned out that playing back-to-back unsigned music was just as irritating as back-to-back Bieber and Dion. Who would know? So Co-op also had to back down on that. So perhaps they should just stop playing music in store. Although the music industry would not want me to say that, because they're very big on retailers having music.
Well, I was listening to someone earlier about how video game music, especially video game music from the 90s, is very clever because it would be playing basically a minute-long loop of music and it wouldn't send you insane.
Like the Tetris music.
Yeah.
So there's some original compositions.
So maybe they should just play like 90s video game music in Walmart from now on.
Look at that. We've solved a problem this, the first edition of the all-new CMU podcast. I'm glad we've reached some resolution there.
So yeah, that's it for the first returning CMU podcast. Please subscribe to it on iTunes and wherever you might subscribe to podcasts.
Unless you're already subscribed and that's how you got it.
Yeah, which is probably the case. But if that's the case, then go and review it. Give it a positive review and a five-star rating. Definitely 5 stars. I think that was a 5-star podcast. And I'm sure everyone agrees. This was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more information on CMU, please go to CompleteMusicUpdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.